I think most of you know this, but I was born and raised Jewish, very involved in Judaism my whole life. And we don't talk about saints. That whole just doesn't exist for Jewish people. In fact, the whole notion of saints, as I was so narrowly focused within my religion, it's there's this very strong, or there was then, I don't know what it would be like to be a child these days growing up within the confines of a traditional, not mystical Judaism, but traditional Judaism. There's such a strong anti-Christ feeling. So anything that's at all Christian, I mean, I remember how hard it was for me to even bring my hands in front of my heart because, you know, it was just, that's what Christians do. Jewish people didn't do that. Sort of interesting. And only yesterday I realized that, of course, these people behind me who I've been intimately involved in now since my, with now, since my late 20s, are saints. And we say that all the time. But I don't hold them in that way. But traveling around to Italy for the in the last 3 years twice has really brought this notion of saints very much to the foreground for me. I did have a connection with St. Francis before I went, whatever that is, some deep spiritual connection to him before I ever went to Italy for the first time, which has just been deepening each time I go. But this last year when we were in Italy, we met a couple of saints that I had known nothing about. I'm sure I'd heard their names, St. Catherine of Siena, it's just very well known, St. Margaret, the saints that we saw. And because their bodies are incorrupt, you actually do get to see them. St. Catherine's a little unusual like this because in the Middle Ages when she lived, it was a very big deal if a saint died to be able to have a piece of their body. And there was also a huge amount of fighting going on, as I'm sure you all know, even within what were called the city-states of Italy. I mean, they were really fighting with each other. Rome and Florence were at it for the longest, but everybody was. It was just, it was a warring moment. I guess this is still a warring moment, but it was big. Somehow it was so brutal when you read these stories, the way they fought, maybe because it was hand-to-hand combat, and it was so accepted in a way. I was reading when I was reading about her that they didn't just execute people. You know, they would make a public display of torturing them for a very long time before they would execute them. And it was just in that way that you feel when you're at the Colosseum, which I went to once and vowed I would never go back. In fact, when we were there, I think you were there with me a few years ago, Eric. I don't know if you were on that part of the trip. Some couple people just got violently ill. And the woman who was, Kirtani, who's an Ananda person who lives and helps run the Assisi community, said almost all the time when she goes there with people, it's a very common thing is what she said. I shouldn't say almost all the time. But she said it's very common, whether it's past life memories or you just feel the energy. Because violence was such a sport. So these things that I was reading about, I had to keep reminding myself, it wasn't experienced then the way we experience it now. Even as I talk about Catherine, who I think in a way made St. Francis look like he took it easy on himself. I mean, she was really into causing pain in many ways for herself. She wanted to experience pain. And now, you know, I couldn't help but think of the line from our festival when I was going through this, whereas suffering and pain and suffering were the coin of man's redemption in the past. I thought, boy, was it ever, really came alive for me. But just back to when she died, having a piece of the body meant a great deal to people. So her devotees decapitated her because they knew that they could never sneak her whole body out of Rome. That the Roman, you know, she had followers everywhere by this time. She was very well known. She was revered as a saint throughout her whole life. So even though she wasn't canonized till much later, the people knew who she was. So they took her head and they took a thumb and they put those in one of the main basilicas in Siena. And when you go to Siena, I mean, there's her head. It's just her head. It's a little odd, but it's still sacred. It has a sacred feeling. The other interesting thing about being, about having been there, is just that. When you can't describe those towns to somebody who's not been there. I've often said after I went to India the first few times, if you tried to describe India to anybody who had never been there, it's just virtually impossible. Because everything you mention, you know, I walked into a store, I was walking down the road, whatever you were doing, it conjures up images like walking down El Camino or walking into Trader Joe's. I mean, it's just, it's more like that in some of the big cities. But when I first started going, you know, there was not a store that had doors on it. And you can't imagine the road. You're walking along with animals and no concrete at that time out of any of the really big cities. So it was just so hard to describe. For the first time, I wanted to take a lot of pictures and bring them back. And these medieval towns in Italy are very much like that. Everything comes alive for you when you're there. And Siena's a unique city in some ways. It's a city that's made of these three hills and then really fairly big drops in between them. And they were saying some of the main streets were like 20 feet wide maybe at the most. Some of them were 14 feet wide. You know, of course, there weren't vehicles. I mean, it was just all so different. But a lot of the cobblestone, a lot of the structure of the city is today as it was then. Many of the buildings are there. And in fact, Catherine's home, and there are several of us here who went this past year, and maybe others of you have gone other times, but you walk into Catherine's home, and you literally can sit and meditate right in front of, I'll tell you a little bit about her childhood, just to give you a context for what happened in her life. But you can't walk into the place where she didn't just meditate there. She took seclusion there for 3 years. She never came out, much to her mother's chagrin. Her father got used to it pretty early on and, in fact, gave her his blessing. But it's barred off. But you can see she was in this 9 by 12 or 13-foot room in the bottom level of this big, I mean, imagine, it's just the medieval, thick, heavy stone building. No windows, no nothing. She took two boards, put them on top of the stone, brought in a big rock to use as a pillow, and then still felt like she was taking it easy. And I mean that literally. It's just who she was. She could not make life hard enough for herself because suffering was the coin of man's redemption. And the way, and she felt that very deeply. So let me just finish that thought. Having been there, it really awakened my curiosity. Plus, she's a saint. So when you're in Siena, you feel that. You feel her presence. You feel her energy. Sitting in her home, meditating, you know, walking in the footsteps of these great masters, it's not like they really went anywhere. To us, they're gone, and we look at just her head, and we think about death. But her energy is as much there as it was. For me, that feeling is most alive in Assisi. You know, you just could feel like you could reach out and grab Francis's hand and go running down these little streets with him and, you know, sit down and listen to him play music and drink wine with him. It would just be, it wouldn't surprise me if he appeared there. She was not quite that playful later in her life, so you don't have, and Siena wasn't as light and airy as Assisi is, but still, you really feel her there. And because she was there, the whole town has maintained that sense of being so sacred. So that's something else. Many people, well, they do have horse races twice a year that draws everybody, but other than that, most people are coming to Siena because Catherine was there. And just to be able to be in her presence like that. She was born in 1347, so really in a medieval time. And again, just painting a little picture, because everything, of course, was so different then. One of the things was very different is by the age of 12, they were already thinking of marrying people off. She was number 24 in terms of children. She was the 24th child that her mother had. And just when I walked in here, there was one more to come, by the way. She was one of a twin, but her mother even got pregnant after her. It was very interesting because she was born a twin. I was starting to think today, how old could her mother have been when she had that first child? I know, to be pregnant 25. Well, she wasn't pregnant 25 times because at least Catherine was a twin. But honestly, I didn't read of any mention of any other twins in the family. There may have been, but they're not. It's not recorded if there were. But maybe she started having children when she was 13. I mean, I don't know. Because Catherine died when she was 33, and that was not uncommon. So people just didn't live the way we live, or most of them didn't anyway, although her mother outlived her. So her mother was clearly a pretty tough, strong woman, which she would have to be. I mean, to go through childbirth that many times, just to be pregnant that many times. When Catherine was born and there were twins, for whatever reason, obviously some divine intervention here, her mother had to make a decision about which child she could nurse and who she would have to find a wet nurse for, because she was pregnant so often that she never had enough milk to nurse all of her children and for as long as she would have liked to have nursed them at that time. So, and she knew that, so she gave the twin to somebody else to nurse, and she kept Catherine. And the twin died within months, actually. And I was realizing as I read, death was something, people just got so used to death because, you know, they had no treatment for anything, nothing. I mean, the only thing they knew how to do were bleed people. They just took blood out for everything when you think of it now, and you realized how many deaths they probably accelerated for that reason. But they just had no idea. They really didn't even have at that point a lot of herbal remedies. That hadn't even become a more sophisticated process in the world yet. So people got very used to people dying. Another interesting thing is that during Catherine's life, the bubonic plague hit Siena twice. And the first time it hit when she was a very young girl, one third of all of Europe's population died. They say 60 to 70% of the people in Siena at the time died. I mean, so it was just massive. You know, they had no idea what it was certainly no idea how to treat it. They didn't know anything about any treatment or antibiotics, until the middle 1900s. I mean, so they had a long way to go. But, you know, they were talking about families just losing 8 to 10 children, you know, and so many people died and left. In fact, one of the men who became as influential as almost anybody else in Catherine's life was an uncle of hers, because she was the last child. You know, she was so much younger, an uncle could be a lot older than her. He was actually only 10 years older than her. But he became a Dominican monk, brother, friar, long before she did, just because he was 10 years older. And he became really a great guide to her, somebody that she went to as a child often, because her family did not want her to become a nun. They did not want her to join any order. Her mother and father were adamantly opposed and really tried to not just insist, but they refused her any access to be able to pray or to follow the life that she wanted. She knew, she had her first major, Christ first came to her when she was 6 years old. And she had a vision of him in papal robes, which is, of course, rather unusual. But he basically said to her, "You're my child. You're going to be doing very unusual things in your life. You'll even leave this city, which was really unheard of for women in those days. You'll be doing a lot of teaching, and just know that I'll be with you at all times. And she went to this uncle, Tomas, and told him about her vision, and he believed her. But everybody else, nobody else really believed her at the time. Until, this is actually a very cute story. She used to try and not only pray a lot, and sit and pray a lot. It really, they call it prayer, but what they were doing was meditating. And I'll read you some. I want to read a lot from the book and then comment on it, because so much of it's in her words. And it's really profoundly touching to hear her words. Like, her energy has been instilled into this book, just the way Master said about the AY. This is a great book, by the way, by this guy, Don Brophy. There's a little bit of stuff he doesn't get. You know, he talks about her fasting as, he calls it holy anorexia. You know, and he says, maybe she had a vision or maybe this happened. But most of the time, he's pretty respectful that something was going on. But it's written in a way that you can actually read it and understand it. And as I'm sure you all know, many of the books about the saints are written in a language that it's like trying to read the Bible and then talk about it on your own. It's just virtually impossible. But they gave her a nickname when she was young. Let me just see if I can find it here. I want to tell you. It's a Greek name, and it means abundance of joy. That's what it means. But let me find it, because I'm going to tell you how he guided her to help her onto the path. Yeah, they named her Euphrosyne, which was apparently one of the mythical graces, and I can't even tell you that I know what that means, but she was given this name, and it really translates into the personification of joy. Yeah, like euphoria, that's right. You saw from, that may be the origin of the word, yeah. People just loved her. She was a bubbly, bouncy, happy child. Frequently, her mother couldn't find her. They said she could never keep track of her. Reminded me of Krishna. It really did. Because everybody wanted her in their home, and they would invite her in, and they would be feeding her, just wanting to make her laugh. She was just filled with joy, and people felt that right away. So then she had this vision when she was six. So she had this name, Euphrosyne, and she went to Tomas, and she said, what am I going to do? I already pledged to Christ when I was six. Now I'm 6 years old. She's a six-year-old talking to him, that I will never marry anybody but him. He's my husband. I'm marrying him. I'm wed to him. And she talked in the way they talked. She was going to drink his blood, be part of his blood. I mean, it's not as gory as it sounds when you really understand how she meant it. But she was wed to him, and he came to her very, very often in her life. And the uncle said, I have an idea. He said there was also a saint, Euphrosyne, in ancient times, he told her, as if those times weren't ancient, but of course didn't feel ancient at the time. And he said she wanted to be in the church like you did. So she cut off her hair, put on a cap, ran away, and hid herself in a way that she could become a monk. It was a woman, but she actually became a monk. So Catherine went home and apparently had very long, beautiful hair, even as a child, and just cut it off. I mean, everybody was upset with her, not just her parents, because in those days, that essentially rendered her unmarriageable. But what her mother said basically was, we're going to tie your hands behind your back and let your hair grow again. It reminded me of Francis being locked up. You know, his father tied him up with chains. This is what it feels like. These saints have very similar experiences. You could walk through any, and our teachers too. I don't know about, but I know about Yogananda's. You could walk through their lives, and they are really challenged. They have to fight hard. I was noticing just the other day, for any of you who got Nityananda's, you know, he sends it out. I don't know if he sends it out monthly, from the EL, and he writes a little blurb each time. And this time, this is before they invite you to everything that's going on at the Expanding Light up at Ananda Village. This time it was on perseverance. And he wrote a very beautiful little blurb about perseverance. And I read that before I was reading about this. But boy, does it take willingness and willfulness and perseverance to be a saint. I mean, it's amazing what these people had to go through. So she cut off her hair. Her mother said, there's no way. We're going to tie you up if we have to. We're going to grow your hair back. And you're getting married. Because the other thing is, her marriage, in the just the way that everything worked, and from a social point of view, a financial point of view, all of her brothers stood to benefit if she got married. And I don't know exactly how that would work with their businesses and everything, but it was very clear her brothers were furious with her. They all became her disciples later, but when she was 6 and 7, they were angry with her. So she continued to meditate, and then you know if you go there, you're told this story. It's one of the big stories of her life, that her father came in one day and watched her. And her father was actually a very pious man. He was a dyer, a D-Y-E-R. He dyed clothes. And he was moderately successful. They were not wealthy. But in and around his business, he went to church every day. He said the mass. And he, you know, he was involved and he knew. And he stood there and this huge shaft of light just came and enveloped her. And he knew right then that he had to give this child to God. So he sort of pulled the mother back and just said, we have to let her go. And it was right after that, so she was now about 7, that he gave her this cell. They rearranged the family home. They moved the living room upstairs to give her some privacy, gave her this, what they call a cell. And she didn't come out for 3 years. She slept on these boards and on this rock, and she fasted. I mean, she fasted to the point of really having nothing but water. Nobody's sure how long these fasts went on. But apparently she was very weak and very sickly a lot of the times. And there's a lot of talk about maybe it was from all of the severe fasting. But she beat herself with ropes and chains, and she would tie chains over other material pieces of wood all over her body to make herself bleed a lot. She was in the midst of a vision with Christ and Mary. Mary was actually often with her. And her cousin came up and started talking to her. So she turned her attention away from Jesus and talked to her cousin. And of course, when she turned back, Christ was gone. And she just started yelling at her cousin, if you could have only seen what I was seeing, you would have never interrupted me. But from that moment on, that became, for her, the source of her greatest sin. For the rest of her life, she felt she would call herself a sinner because she turned her back on Christ. And it's very interesting. It reminded me of the story that Swamiji told, which I think all of us have heard, because he spoke a lot about never taking for granted when you're having a profound moment with God. You know, never let it be interrupted by anything when you're feeling whatever for each of us would be that deep of a connection. And, you know, he always told the story. I never remember the name of the place in, you know, it's that, it's not England, but it's a big spiritual community where they grow a lot of organic food. Findhorn, thank you. And who was ever with the head of Findhorn, Swamiji was very close with him. And he told that story about how they had waited years to have enough money to pave their road. And that man from Findhorn said to Swamiji, my wife called me in to eat and I knew I shouldn't go. I knew it, but I left and I went in and the driveway's still not finished. I mean, it was like years later. That's about a driveway, but that's the story that Swamiji told. I mean, there is something about it. Every story that I read about her, there's a story in our path. And that's part of what I want to share with you tonight. Can I say this? It's not as if we don't know that the truth is the truth. It's not like we would be surprised that Catherine in 1340 and 1350 is having these same experiences and in her language speaking exactly the same lessons that Master gave us and that Swamiji interpreted for us. It wouldn't surprise us if we think about it. But when you hear it and you read it, it's just thrilling over and over. There's no other way to describe it. You just, you know, every once in a while when I'm talking to somebody who's newish on the path, I find myself saying to them, when you live on the path long enough, you start seeing, everybody does, not just me, we see what most of the people in the world would call miracles. They start happening. And it can be as simple as you don't get angry when somebody does something that would have made you angry. Or somebody comes up and criticizes you, and in that moment you don't get defensive. You say, no, I'm open to hear this. I mean, maybe it doesn't happen all the time, but when it happens, it feels like a miracle. I mean, that you're that in control of your feelings. Never mind the miracles that have happened. And obviously they've happened to a lot of us. This is what's in Asha's book. I mean, I felt like I probably gave Asha four times as many things that have happened in my life as got there, because it's what happens when you, you know, it's like for those who have ears to hear and eyes to see, and you start realizing that there are miracles. After a period of time, you know without a doubt that what the masters are telling us, all of the teachings, whether you've had this experience or not, you know, I mean, how many of us have had an experience of samadhi, you know, just for instance, but many other experiences, how many of us could bilocate, or how many of us could go months or years without eating, as Catherine did or other saints do, but we know it to be true because we've seen enough now that we just don't question the miracles. And I'm saying it as a we, because I'm certain I'm not the only person here who's had this experience. After a while, you say, this happened, that happened, this happened, I saw this, I saw that, I saw it with my own eyes, and it's just real. Still, when you see those miracles or experience them, it's thrilling. And that's the way reading this book, and I have a couple of other books at home that I went through, just to prepare myself, because honestly, I didn't know anything about her life. But here she is, speaking a language as a Dominican. So not as a self-realizationist, but as a Dominican, 1,000 years ago. And it's just us. It's just exactly our teachings. And really, what really fascinates me is that she says it to those people in almost, I mean, the language is a little different, but not by that much. It doesn't sound like she's speaking some other language. She just speaks like you go, oh, look at that. Here's how she's talking about meditation, or here's how she's talking about perseverance or courage or whatever it is. And I'll read a little bit of that. What wound up happening to her is eventually, with a lot of effort on her part, and because of her visions with Christ that were kept telling her, you need to be out in the world. You are not to be cloistered, which of course most of the women who became nuns were cloistered at that time. And it's fascinating about her. She couldn't bear the thought of leaving her room for 3 years. She couldn't bear the thought of being out in the world. And then when it came time to find her path, she couldn't bear the thought of being cloistered. And she says, and the people who write about her say, and this is an interesting thing about pilgrimage and about seclusion, that it took that intense time for her to go as deep as she went and to have all of the realizations that she did to be able to be out in the world and hold on the way she did. That really we have to provide that kind of space for us. She clearly came in as a saint, and perhaps we could call her an avatar. I don't know. I mean, they don't use that language, so I don't know. But she knew from the moment she came in that she was different. That's why she would sit, even before she was sick, she wouldn't eat with her family. And she would say to them, I need you to understand that I'm different from all of you. I mean, you hardly think she would be old enough to be speaking. And she would say these words to them. I'm not like you. What you need, I don't need. What I need right now, you know nothing of. I mean, these are how she would speak, as this little adorable pipsqueak running around making everybody in the world happy. You know, it's just sort of a fascinating story. But she knew that she had to go inside. And she even says later there are times where she's lamenting the fact that she doesn't have, in many moments, because her work got so big, that uninterrupted time for prayer. And she doesn't say it that way. She says, for time with my husband and, you know, to drink his blood and all the way she talked about it. But she meant she needed a seclusion. I thought, oh, I'm not the only one who's saying I need a seclusion. I mean, here was Catherine. But she really spoke that way later in life. So 3 years alone, and then she knew that she could not be cloistered. And as I said, Jesus had just made it abundantly clear. So she became what's called a tertiary with the Dominican order. So they're sort of like a lay order. They're part of the order, but they're out in the world. And they're meant to do, in those days, most of the women were meant to do nursing or teaching, but not preaching. But Jesus said to her loud and clear over and over, you will be teaching and preaching and you'll go outside of your city again, which was a big deal to hear that. She was illiterate. She couldn't read or write. She never learned really to read or write, though there are a couple of things that, so she always had scribes with her and she would just dictate things. Interestingly, the big book that she wrote, which I did not read, called The Dialogue, which is just her teachings. Now I'm inspired and I will read it at some point. Some people say it was written in 5 days. I mean, it's a massive volume. And then they said you could see it was edited a little, but obviously just a completely inspired work. So it's pretty remarkable person. So let me find some of my, because I am going to do this right a little bit from the book here. Yeah, another thing that I read about today that I didn't know is that these mystical marriages to Christ, which is what she said she was in, apparently was very common for children at the time, or more common. They called them penitent children. So there were, I don't know why it was happening then. It intrigued me that at such a dark time in history that enough children that people are writing about it would be having these mystical experiences with Jesus. So she told her parents, of course, Jesus had already been around and had already said, the mountains could just as easily move if you try and, what's the phrase from the Bible? I'm not going to remember it right now. But he referred to, if you think that you could move me, that you could just as easily move these rocks. And she told her parents that at one point when they were trying to break her will, she said to them, it would be easier for you to soften the rocks that I'm standing on than to turn me away from God at this point. So I just want to, I'm going to open the book now because I want to, in many instances, read her words and then talk a little bit about them. But this is a very interesting. I said to myself today, Shanti, do not try and read them this whole 250-page book. But you know, it's so rich and it's just so uplifting. But at one point, when her mother was really angry with her and telling her, we're going to grow your hair back and you are not going to follow this path that you think you're going to follow, her mother yelled at her and apparently used some language that Catherine did not like. And she said to her mother, beat me as you think fit, but I beg you never, she's about 5 or maybe 6 when she's saying this to her, but I beg you never lose control of your own tongue as to curse anyone, good or bad. She says to her, "That for you is a thing unbecoming your venerable age. And as for me, it wounds me to the heart." And then Catherine went on, it says, to explain that after requesting the Mass, I don't know what that means, it doesn't matter, but later, Lapa was her mother's name, L-A-P-A, Lapa, listened to this in wonderment, and later she mentioned the incident to her husband, and she said, "Do you know what your daughter just said to me? Like, did you hear that? I mean, here was this little girl saying, 'This is so bad for you, mother. You can never speak.' I mean, here she was beating her and yelling at her, but she didn't say, 'Don't hurt me.' She said, 'It just hurts my heart so much what you're doing to yourself.'" When her mother first brought her back home and was upset with her for cutting her hair, she locked off the room where she used to meditate, and she made her start cleaning the house for hours and hours every day. It would just give her one chore after another. And when she was asked later how she got through this time, Catherine said, "I just used to imagine that I was employed at the house of the Holy Family in Bethlehem, and that her mother and father were Joseph and Mary, parents of her future husband." And again, these are what she was saying. I just keep reminding you. She was this tiny little girl. And later on, the Pope or somebody close to the Pope sort of assigned this man, Raymond of Capua, to her. And he basically spent her whole life with her. He lived 10 years longer than she did. And he was given to her by the Pope as a protector, you know, so that she wouldn't be traveling alone or out in cities. And also he had to interpret for her at times, and he had to be a scribe, again, because she was illiterate. And it said he would recall years later, whenever he complained to her of being burdened by duties or obligations, she would tell him, "Build yourself a cell within your heart and never put a foot outside it." Isn't it just so beautiful? I mean, those are words that I could so easily, I mean, I really felt like I learned something when I read that. Build yourself a cell, which is a meditation space, in your heart and never set a foot outside of it. I just think her words, the way she uses words, are so beautiful. I wanted to read you some of these. Let's just take a moment all the time for me to do this, because I wanted to just read you some of this. This is what it said. She had already reduced her food intake to almost nothing. She arranged a few boards on the floor. Stone is her pillow. She acquired a hair shirt, right, which is notoriously uncomfortable, and would wear it all the time next to her skin. And then it says, not completely satisfied by that, she obtained a thin chain that she wrapped around her body so that it chafed her around her wrists, her ankles, and left her raw. For years, she practiced self-flagellation. Initially, she used the rope, then later iron chains. Isn't it amazing? She goes on to explain many times to a lot of people what suffering meant to her. And Jesus came to her one time, and he said to her, you know, I mean, she took this however she took it, and she was a saint herself, so, I mean, who am I to decide whether she interpreted it correctly? But at one point, when she was saying to Jesus, you know, "This is hard," he said to her, "Would you rather suffer in this life or the next life?" I mean, he actually was just saying to her, whatever little bit of karma there is right now, let's just burn that off for you. Very interesting. She had a wonderful vision. I'm just trying to think of when this was. This is another, I'm sorry. As I said, I'll just keep doing this. At one point, she was suffering with a lot of temptations in her in her meditation, in her prayer. And she says this, these are her words, the only way to avoid this kind of self-deception is to chip away slowly at the calcified human ego. Isn't that amazing that she said that? Chip away slowly. And she realized when she went into solitude that her very strength, which was this strong ego, this strong sense of commitment to what she needed, the way she had to be so strong with her family in the early days, she said, it came to me in a vision that it was now my weakness because I needed that strong ego before and now I had to, and she said, chip away at a calcified human ego. She said later that her years as a recluse were the very opposite of leisure time. They were hard work. Then she had this vision. She saw a tree, and it was surrounded by like brambles and thorns, and the tree itself was very smooth. And she saw a lot of people approaching the tree, but they didn't want to go near the thorns, so they just left. And then the next group of people came, would walk through the thorns and let themselves get bloody, and you know, and then they would try and climb the tree, but they would keep sliding back down and then turn around and walk away. And then she saw one person come and walk through the brambles and make it all the way up the tree. And she said, fully aware that her way to fulfillment would be painful, requiring courage and perseverance. That's when I thought of Nityananda's, I mean, that vision came to her. And such clear visions that were all recorded very much the way Frances's visions were, that really gave her instruction. I mean, often she would have dreams or these clear visions to show her the way next. Here's something else that really intrigued me. Is that she wrote one of her fondest images was the body of Christ, whose wounds offer access to humans. She wrote this. And then she said, one enters his body by the wounds of the feet and moves upward as though on a staircase, ascending all the time. You know, so here she is describing the astral spine and the chakras, at last reaching the center of Christ's being, where the seeker's own body disappears. It's just, it's so wonderful, you know, just seeing how much of this is us. So, this was interesting, another little interesting story. She was desperate to join one of these orders. She wanted to join the Dominican order specifically. She knew that, though, of course, the Franciscan order was there as well. And they wouldn't let her because they were mostly only taking, they would only take widowed older women, women who were not going to be as appealing. Again, particularly as tertiaries because they were out in the world. And so she started begging her mother to go, and her mother would go to speak to these Dominican nuns several times, and they wouldn't let her. And so Catherine basically said, well, you know, we'll have to do something about that. And within weeks, she developed what sounds like, I mean, nobody's sure, but severe chicken pox that just covered her whole body. And then her mother took her. Her mother went one more time. She said to her mother, now you go. And they said to her mother, well, is she pretty? And her mother said, well, why don't I bring her here and you can see her? And then they found this person just covered with these ugly, suppurative, you know, oozing pox marks. And so then they said, okay, we'll take her. I mean, it was amazing how she, what she did to get to be part of this order. I have to rearrange these papers to make them readable to me. They just point me to pages. You know, I'm not used to doing this, but there's no way to do this other than have this be a book study, because you can't paraphrase these people. I mean, you can talk about it a little bit, but you can't. Their words are so perfect. There's not one extra preposition even in what they write. It's just like that. They tell you what you need to know, and that's it. And it just feels like it would be doing such an injustice to them. Here she talks about duality. The emphasis on 2 feet and 2 wings underscores this was in another vision that she had. That she listened to this voice that said, on 2 feet you must walk my way, on 2 wings you must fly to heaven. And she realized that they were teaching her about dual obligations, that where you have to do work inside and you then had to be with God. You know, so you had to move back and forth between feeling one with the divine, her work, and going out into the world. She was 20 years old now by this time when all of this was happening. And she was being, the temptations she experienced were not unusual in and of themselves. Into her mind floated unsought invitations to relax her austerities, to ease up her life of prayer, to take more pleasure in people and surroundings. And she said there didn't seem to be anything particularly evil in any of them, but they were temptations. And it's just, you know, fascinating how much we think of that. No one thing that we do that keeps taking us away from God looks like it's horrible. Most of them are not. It's just our attention's elsewhere. Our cousin walks up and we're steeped in meditation and we go, oh yeah, I'll go out for dinner with you. I'll go to whatever I'll do away from God. She said she sometimes referred to the devil as the old pickpocket, someone who would sidle up in a friendly way, but then, before one knew what was happening, disappear with one's purse. Very clever. She had a very clever way with words. Though, again, she could never read or write. She was, she did 3 main things during her life, really. She did a huge amount of preaching, really. And she, very much like Frances, started, you know, who was her first disciple, then her second. It just built like that until soon she would have, you know, everybody in the town would just stand outside and listen to her talk. And she also did a lot of healing, a lot of nursing. A lot of the stories of the miracles in her life are around healing that are just wonderful. And maybe we'll get to hear a couple of them, or maybe we won't. The other thing she did was she was a huge political force in her time, huge. People would come to her adamantly holding on to the thought that they were opposed to her. And they very much reminded me of the story when Master was tested as a child, you know, when, I can't remember when that happened, but he was still in India, when somebody asked him, these two scholars or whoever they were asking him questions. And Master answered, of course, from his place of knowing, not just having read and memorized. And they realized in that moment who he was. And she has a lot of stories like that. People came to get her, to prove her wrong, to do her in many ways. And she had so many different ways, I'd like to find a couple of them, of just disarming people. Often they would just come into her presence and they were so taken with her that they would convert right in front of her and become her disciples. But here I just wanted to say that she was working in a leper hospital. And, of course, her whole family was really upset about it because, you know, they didn't, of course, didn't want her to get leprosy. But she just would have nothing. She wouldn't listen to them, of course, about not going there. But as she was working with the lepers, she developed a really strange rash on her hands. Didn't look like leprosy, but it was a strange rash. And one of the people that she had been working the most closely with died. And everybody said to her, Catherine, don't you, because, you know, they would wash the body and do whatever the ablutions were. Don't you do that. Let us do it. They just didn't want her to get that close. But she insisted on taking care of this woman bathing her, wrapping her body, and they said, and buried her with her own hands, at which time, that very moment, the whole rash just disappeared. You know, the rash that was on her. I mean, stories, one miracle after another, that were just delightful. I hope I get to one of them before we run out of time here. I'm going to read you. I'm trying to read to you some of the principles that I found that are principles on our path. If she was not beautiful, there was still something about her looks and manner that attracted people. It was not so much her features, but her liveliness and spirit that seemed to captivate those who met her. And then there's all these writings by all these different people who talked about her smile, her joyfulness. She was remarkably tender. And the man who's writing this book just says, as I read all of this, he was collecting all this work, he said, I realized she had a magnetism unlike anybody. I mean, and just goes on then to talk about magnetism as it related to her. People just couldn't resist her. At one point, everybody was starving. You know, it was the time of the plague and a very difficult time in Siena. And people went and found the wheat that they had put aside for just this time, but it had turned completely moldy. And Catherine said, just bring me the wheat. I'll turn it into something, and everybody in the town will be able to live off of it. And she turned this into these little loaves of bread that everybody said were the best bread that they had ever eaten. And no matter how many people she had to feed, the loaves of bread just kept coming. And the wheat stores never diminished. You know, so, I mean, it's just, again, miracle after miracle, but so charming to read. So in the meantime, she's traveling now. She's building up what is called the famiglia, but her family, her spiritual family, is growing. And now by this time, it's huge. Often she would have to take a trip to another city, and there would be hundreds of people. I think it was really pilgrimage for them. They would just follow her wherever she went. And they talk about another town they would go to or mention it was like 65 miles away. But they were walking. You know, it was like Francis. I mean, it was very difficult what they were doing. But everybody would just follow her wherever she was going. And there's a story in here that I'm not going to try and find about people who were particularly mean and critical of her. And she says that she says in here, when challenged openly, she disarmed antagonists by thanking them for their charitable correction. That, she said, benefited her immensely. You know, she just would not ever get angry with anybody. Again, I keep holding in my mind, she died when she was 33. I mean, such a very much, in so many instances, she reminds me of both Swamiji and Master. Of course, that's a lesson that came. Here's one of her stories, that these Franciscans came to see her, and they said they were going to challenge her right to offer spiritual direction to disciples, because they couldn't imagine that somebody who was illiterate could do it, and they simply couldn't imagine that a woman was doing it. You know, this was so unheard of. For a woman to be even out alone on the streets of her town was unheard of. Never mind to be traveling around the whole country and preaching and drawing crowds like that. So the two theologians found her at home, surrounded by her disciples, and at once began to question her. Rather than respond to their questions, Catherine turned to Friar Gabriel and demanded to know how he could offer spiritual advice when he did not honor the Franciscan ideal of poverty. Now, she had never met this man before. With all your wisdom, you are of little use to your fellow men and positively hurtful to yourself because you seek the shell of Christ's teaching and not the kernel, she said to him. For the love of Christ crucified She screamed at him, "Give up this life of yours." And then she said he was totally caught off guard, and he realized that she knew that his friary was furnished with lavish hangings and fabrics. He immediately produced the keys and told the men who had followed him, "Go back and take everything away and give it away." He was a Franciscan, but he asked her to adopt him as her son. I mean, this is just what she did with people. But these are the two stories that I was so taken with. Because there was this rivalry between the Franciscans and the Dominicans that was always brewing. I mean, why not then? It always seems to be there. It says it dated back to the years when Bonaventure and Aquinas were teaching at the University of Paris. I'm sure they were having their debates, and it just took off like that. I mean, really interesting to me that it happens. But because of this rivalry, this man, Lazzarino, who was, again, a Franciscan, he had so many reservations about him. So one of her disciples, who he was friends with, said, "Come and let me show you her." So this is interesting. I mean, to that first man, a story I just told you, she just confronted him and yelled at him. In this instance, he came in, and she sat on the floor immediately when he came, and he sat up on a clothes chest, and he started questioning her about the scriptures. And she said, and it says she confessed she knew little about scripture and asked the Franciscan to enlighten her, which he did at some length. And she just kept nodding and asking questions. And then when it was time to go, she escorted him to the door, and she knelt in the doorway for his blessing. But he went home that night, and he couldn't sleep. He felt agitated. He felt restless. He started, anytime he'd doze off, he'd have these horrible dreams. He said he couldn't figure out what was wrong, but he just couldn't bear to be in himself. And in his mind's eye, suddenly, and early in the morning, he saw her just sitting calmly on the floor the way she had, saying, "Just teach me whatever you can teach me." And he said all of a sudden he started realizing there was something about her, her posture, her face, her stillness. I mean, he wrote this. So as the more he thought about her, all this sadness, all this agitation just left him. And so he went back over to her place, literally the next morning. This time when she opened, he knelt and asked for her blessing. And then they went in and they both sat on the floor and they meditated. And he asked her to adopt him as a son and guide him on the path to God. She answered that he knew the path better than she, being a scholar. And when he demurred, insisting he knew only the externals, while she knew the heart. So she spoke to him of St. Francis, because he was a Franciscan. And the meaning, she taught him, interestingly, the meaning, it said, of the belt and the three knots, which, of course, in the Franciscan order, stand for chastity, poverty, and obedience. And she said to him, "Why don't you just follow humbly in the footsteps of the crucified Christ and your father Francis?" I mean, such extraordinary calm and upliftedness. And they go on to say all the reasons why so much opposition came to her. Again, that she was a woman. I mean, there's all these reasons why they give, but she never demurred herself. She was so unbelievably strong. Anyway, she eventually, I knew this, but I didn't actually really remember all of it, but that the Pope, for many, many years, had left Rome and was living in France, in Avignon. And a lot of the Catholic people felt terrible about this because they were living away from the vast majority of Catholics, and they were living out of the, out of the sight, the vision, the proximity. It was very difficult in those days. And she knew that she wanted the Pope to move back to Rome. The Pope that was Pope when she was first born, who I forget right now, died. And then Gregory the 11th became Pope. And he was intrigued by her. he didn't meet her for a very long time, but he actually was intrigued by the idea of a woman preaching and writing. And she wrote him a letter very early on, many years before they ever met, and told him in these inspired words what his true purpose as a pope had to be and how he could only fulfill that if he lived in Rome, and how he had to be there to take care of Rome. Again, there were all these wars and battles, and he was afraid to go back to Rome. He was afraid for his life. But she started visiting him, and over many years, not only did he finally agree to go back to Rome, and many times she saved his life. She would appear at the last moment and literally just raise her arms, and people would come after her with swords, and different people would come to kill her. And very much like what happened with Master, they would have their arm raised. And she actually wanted to die a martyr. To her, that's what a good Christian did. I mean, she would sit there and pray that they would kill her, but they couldn't kill her. Many times people would do this. At one time, there was this rioting going on in Siena. And they were, for some reason, after two of her brothers, who had also become monks now, and they were hiding out in a castle far away, but they had some job they had to do. I don't remember what it was. And they had to go right through the city where all of these riots were. And she said, "Follow me, I'll get you there." And she raised her mantle, this habit that she wore. Apparently it was a very big, imposing mantle. I didn't look up any pictures of it, but it keeps being described that way. And they said she just walked like this with her brothers behind her, and people would just become rapt with her. They just couldn't, whatever they thought they were going to say or do, they were just paralyzed, but in a state of near ecstasy. So she was just able to walk her brothers right through these thousands of people who had just wanted to kill them. But she did the same thing with the Pope, and she actually brought the Pope back to Rome. And it was after that that the new St. Peter's Square and everything, I mean, in the next 100 years, was built. And that's one of the things that she's known for. When she was preaching, she could only speak about Christ for so long, and then she would clearly go into samadhi. I mean, it was talked about her body would become rigid. They would watch her not breathing. Many times people would be terrified that she was dying. I don't really think they knew about resuscitation then, because there's no comment about it. I mean, there's a lot of written records from the time, so we're reading stuff in here that was written. And so people would just, I mean, you can imagine what it's like to be right near somebody who's going into samadhi all the time. And every sermon or talk, I mean, sermon, she wasn't in a church, she wasn't even allowed to be, but just talk out on the square, she would just go off into samadhi, and people just wanted to be near her. And I mean, thousands of people who were in her presence would have these totally, in that moment, life, totally transformational experiences. And then it was just like Krishna, like a Pied Piper. Those people then would be following her. Then the next people would be following her. She certainly had a lot of enemies. I mean, she did. People who just couldn't get that she was a woman. It was mostly that, and that she was doing it. And also, at that time, the fact that she was illiterate just made her suspect to so many people. Like, how could she? Because, of course, they were not dealing from an experience of the divine. And she was. And they just couldn't get how somebody could know these things if they couldn't read and write. And, I mean, there are stories here of the people who were then in her presence and who transcended. There's at one point where she was really talking specifically to whoever she was talking to. I don't remember right now. But about this difference between book-acquired knowledge and the knowledge with God and just knowing about God. I mean, one of her visions very early on in her life, Mary came to her and took her arm and lifted it up, and then Jesus came and put a ring on her finger. And he said to her, "You've been saying since you were six that you're wed to me. Now we're formally wed." So she was having all these experiences, but I think at the time it was just so impossible for people to believe it. There's another story that's told. At one point, she went, there was a woman who was revered as a saint. And I want to say Margaret, but it wasn't the Saint Margaret of Corona, somebody else, I think that was the name. And she went to see her after she had died. The body was still there. And she went to kneel down, Catherine did, to touch this woman's feet. And this woman's foot just came up to greet Catherine. I mean, she had been dead for a long time. And the woman's foot. And there were so many people still, like just like what would happen today, who doubted so much that any of this is real, that they just came up with all of these excuses and reasons for why these things happened. So, okay, let me just end with one or two more little things and we can be done. It says here, far more important in Pius's acknowledgement, this is when she was being canonized, that Catherine enjoyed the direct infusion of knowledge from God. This is the essence of mysticism, the author says, an intimate and personal relationship with the transcendent God. Her knowledge came down to her from heaven, hence she could teach without having had masters. This is what the church is saying about her, you know, hundreds of years later. Then in 1940, she and Francis, in the middle of the war, were named the patron saints of Italy. And then in 1999, Pope John Paul II expanded that by naming her one of six patron saints of Europe. So she was fully recognized not that many years ago, actually. Does anybody have any comments or questions? I know. Vinnie, do you have anything else from when we were there?
It just makes me, I'm reminded of the benefit of why Master said to, when we read about the saints, to read about those that are in our line, meaning the mystics, because you know, it broadens our family. You know, these are brothers and sisters and cousins of our lineage, and it helps us draw just new inspirations, and that's what we live for, these moments of inspiration, so that we too can find the energy to follow in the footsteps. And Anand, I remember Anand constantly throughout our pilgrimage just reminding us of why Master said of following the saints that are in our line, the mystics. And yeah, it's very inspiring just to see our family grow in these ways, our saint family.
Yeah, that's very well said, Vinnie. I really appreciate your saying that. I was surprised in these last couple of days, as I just, because that's when I started reading this, at how inspired I felt, and how inspired I felt to go deeper on my path. I mean, that you can just hear, I hope, in the little tidbits that I said, just the teachings are the same. And I've heard Master said that, and I know Anand, I heard Anand say that, but I didn't ever really cognize it until you just said it's because it's the mystics. I always knew it about Francis. You know, you can feel Master and Francis when you're in Assisi. As I said, it wouldn't surprise me at all if Francis and Master just came out and each one took one of my hands. And of course, we feel Swamiji there so clearly in Assisi. His presence is so real. But it surprised me just how close I felt to her. And I think it's because of what you're saying. It's because it's the mystics, and the teachings are absolutely the same from 1300 till 1920. But I mean, even the language, that's why I was reading you some of it. It's not like it was hard to read this. So, yeah, very beautiful. Hold on, David. Do you mind taking the mic?
I'm always so intrigued to see the interplay between the saints who know God and the scholars who know about God.
I know.
And it's the same everywhere, in every tradition, all the time.
Yeah.
So there's the mystical branch, and then there's the church, and the saints are always inconvenient. They used to shuttle Padre Pio around and hide him because everyone would want to go be with a saint. Who wants to be with a scholar? You know, so it's fun to see that playing in her life. It's the exact same story.
Yeah, it's so amazing. Well, that's what I really got, that they couldn't imagine. And I was sitting there today thinking, imagine what it's like for them. All they've ever known is you have to read and learn, and it has to be passed down that way. Which saint was it? I don't know if it's Saint Teresa of Avila, who they had to get other saints who had mystical experiences to come, men, and say, yes, this can happen. You can know God without form, or nobody would believe her. And I think it was Teresa of Avila, because it must just be unimaginable. That's what I was talking early on in this class, the great joy of being exposed to these masters and Swamiji all these years, and being able to see miracles. Because then you know, I mean, I've never been in Samadhi, but I know these, I can feel when the teachings are coming through somebody who's had the experience. But if you've never had that, and the other interesting thing that you said, and I agree with, is that was 1300, but it happened when Jesus was here. It's always the same. Nothing ever changes in that way. It's so interesting. I'm eager for the time, the yuga, when in fact those who have the experience are the ones who are the majority, not the ones who are book taught. It'll be fun. Yeah. I just want to say, I mean, none of us have any spare time. I looked through about 3 books, and as I said, many of them are hard to read. They really are. But this one, I'd be happy to loan it to anybody if ever you want to take a look at it. It's just, it's a fun thing to do. So, next week, I am not here, and David is going to be giving the class next week on Ananda Moy Ma, and then I'll be back the 3rd week, and it's a surprise, because I don't know, I haven't been told yet who I should talk about. It's going to be a surprise to me, too. I can't decide. I was thinking, I really planned on doing Francis, but I think maybe, I love talking about Francis, and I feel so close with him, and there's a wonderful book that was written about Francis by St. Bonaventure, interestingly, who says that he was healed by Francis when he was a baby. And, you know, because he wasn't really, Bonaventure was not around that much while Francis was. And that book is such a joy to read. Bonaventure was a beautiful writer and poet. And he just writes about Francis with just his heart so totally wide open. So, yes, I'll talk about Francis then. That. You see, God spoke to me through you. Thank you, Erica. Yeah. Anybody else? Comments? Heidi? Yeah.
I thought I recalled hearing that Catherine was received how to write and read from Christ. Did you read anything about that? It came to her in vision, or?
Well, there's questions about it, but nobody's sure. At least from I read 2 books completely and scanned a couple of others, so I don't feel like I'm an authority on it, and the authorities disagree anyway. I mean, about a lot of these things, it's interesting how much they disagree, but some people say that there's a couple of letters of hers, because she's, you know, there's books of her letters. She wrote letters very much like Sister Gyanamata. She was very much in the same role. That was another analogy. And her letters are filled with wisdom. I read a few of them. They're just, boy, you would have loved to have been on the receiving end. But, you know, a lot of people didn't realize then that they should save those letters. So many, many, many of her letters are not around. There's a few of those, or a couple of pieces, where they said she was inspired, and people think she actually wrote certain small pieces by herself, even though she was illiterate. She desperately wanted to learn. I mean, she meant it even in an earthly way when she said to that, the Franciscan who came, but how could I know? You're the learned one. Teach me. She always wanted to learn to read and write. And there was a moment in her life where somebody was teaching her, and then that person died or something, but she really hadn't gotten very far with it. She could never write like how she spoke. I mean, she, you know, there's volumes that she dictated. The dialogue, the letters, there's a lot that is here that she wrote. But there are some statements that there are moments where she was inspired and she could just write. And even that she wrote to, now I'm blocking on his name, the man who was with her most of her life, and said, I actually wrote a letter by myself. But then there's been arguments about it, so I don't know. But the whole time I was reading all of it, I thought, oh, come on. Of course, if she needed to write, she could have written. I mean, clearly it was better for her. They said nobody could keep up with her, you know, and she loved to talk, apparently. She would just talk and talk and talk, and people would actually fall asleep. I mean, it reminded me of Jesus, and then she would yell at them. She would yell at them, in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord, would you wake up? I may as well be talking to the walls, she said a couple of times. Really get mad at them. But sometimes she would have two people. What they said was very interesting is that she would be dictating to her scribes, and she would get interrupted and have to go do something. And often they said she would have like three letters going at once, and the inspiration would come here, and then, I mean, at the same time in a room. Then she'd get called away, and she could come back hours or days later and just pick up like there had never been a break. I mean, none of it should be surprising because she is who she is, but it's so delightful reading about it. You know, and everybody around her would just be amazed. They said, just pick up. It could be mid-sentence, and she would just pick up where she was. Anyway. Okay, everybody. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Shanti.
I'm glad this happened.